Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, where we don't just talk about success, we hand the mic to the people actually out there redefining it. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and if you thought you knew what it meant to play big, listen up, because today's guest makes thinking outside the box look like child's play. We're talking to a woman who funds billion-dollar projects before breakfast, mentors innovators heading to Mars, and still finds time to call out the nonsense in business financing. She's not just in the room where it happens. She's building the damn room, launching it into space, and making sure it's solar powered while she's at it. Yvonne Gamble is a venture capitalist, a futurist, a keynote speaker, a humanitarian, and let's be clear, a force of nature. As CEO of Sanpeet Financial Group, she helps entrepreneurs secure serious capital without giving away the keys to their kingdom, teaching them how to play smart with non-dilutive financing and integrate AI like they actually mean business. She's judged NASA's Space Innovation Challenges, mentored at the Department of Defense. She leads 10 companies. Yes, 10, and hosted a global broadcast streamed straight into Davos. Oh, and did I mention she's a two-time international best-selling author? Her latest book, Financing Your Next Billion Dollars, Know Your Impact, Stand Out from the Crowd, and Get Funded, is basically a survival guide for anyone serious about raising capital without losing control. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on what it really takes to fund your next big move. Why entrepreneurs need to rethink how they approach investors and how public speaking has amplified Yvonne's mission on a global scale. So if you're tired of playing small and ready to hear from someone who's rewriting the rules of business, tech, and beyond, this conversation is for you. Yvonne Gamble, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Kelly. That was just such a wonderful introduction. My goodness, I don't need to say anything. I think we're done. No,
well,
thank you so much.
I love it, but honestly, we're just getting started. You are a wealth of information, and I am so glad to have you on the show because there are people out there, entrepreneurs who I love dearly, businesses that want to scale, that need to know more about the financing world, and you are the perfect guest for us. We're going to get to a lot of that, but question is, I got to go back to where this all starts because I want people to know how you got into this, and why it became your passion, and why you've been so successful. So for someone who's built an empire across multiple industries, most people only dream of stepping into, we're talking venture capital, tech, real estate, even space innovation. Please take me back and let me know what spark you got that lit this fire for you.
Well, I have to be truly honest. It was not me. It started with my great-grandfather, Andrew Jackson Beard, and he is the inventor of the automated Jenny coupling device. It is a device that couples trains, planes, automobiles, and any hinges on any mechanical device that you can think of. That's what it couples. And what really got me into this, and he was also the inventor of about 43 other patents here in the United States.
Wow.
What got me to going into the finance area, this was an area that I had an idea what I wanted to do. I was an A-plus student, one of those, the overachievers, messing up the bell curve, that sort of thing. And I loved science. I love mathematics. I love English literature and art. Science was my passion. And so was mathematics, because the two really go hand in hand. And what I did was I prayed my way into this business. I didn't know what to do. I could type 95 words a minute. I wasn't being sent out for interviews. I came to the nice big city of Chicago. Everyone was going out getting interviews. I wasn't. So I simply got down on my knees and I prayed. I said, Lord, I want to work in an industry that touches people's lives from the time they're born until the time they die. I had no idea what I was praying for or what I was just, I knew what I was praying about, where I wanted to work. And I wanted to work in the city of Chicago. And so I was there. So that was one part of that was already answered. I was in Chicago. And so I basically went to sleep that night, got up, opened up the big yellow pages. First ad I saw was this big eagle perched on a mold, and it said, "We're American National Bank. We're the bank for business." And that's who I called. And an hour later, I'm sitting there in the office and I got the job. Working in the $1 million banking division.
Just like that.
Just
Just
like
like
that.
that. Walked in,
Yes, and
applied,
walked in.
had a good records behind you, good
Those,
school records, but just
all
that's
those
it.
fields. It wasn't so, let me tell you what it was. It was not simply the school records, because he didn't even have time for that. I called, they opened at 8 a.m., the HR department. I called. And the person who answered the phone was actually the director of human resources. And you know why he answered the phone? Because the receptionist was not there. The administrator had not been there. They were late that day. By the time I got, he said, "How long will it take you to get down here?" I says, "I can be down in an hour." He says, "Okay, come on down." I got down there in less than an hour. I knew it. Always promise long, deliver short. I knew how to do that. So I was there in about 30 minutes. And when I got there, they still hadn't come in. So he said, "I think I have to give you a typing test." And I said, "Yes." And so he took me to this room. It had all types of typewriters. He said, "Just pick out whatever typewriter that you want to and type." And so I said, "Okay." He said, "Let me find a typing test." Couldn't find one. He said, "I have a letter that I'm working on." And he says, "Could you just type this letter?" And I said, "Sure." He had a lot of red lines on it, what have you. I saw where some of the grammars or some words could be a little bit better, sentence structure, what have you. And I did. I fixed it. And so when I gave it to him, he's sitting there, he's reading it. He said, "Oh, yeah, this makes better sense. This sounds much better." He said, "Oh, you changed this?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Can you do me an envelope? I'll go find an envelope." I said, "Oh, no." And I handed him the envelope. I already had typed the envelope. Okay, hold that.
Beautiful.
And I want your audience to hold that and to understand that, because we're going to talk about that very thing that I did that landed me that job making five figures. Okay, at 18. I just graduated on June the 6th, and I'm working on July the 19th.
Wow.
Okay,
Wow. That's
so.
so that's really, as you describe that. That's someone who had at least a vision of a portion of a vision, but was certainly open to the opportunity showing up for them. But what was even better is you were ready for it. You were
Exactly.
ahead of the game.
There you go. I was ready for what came. And so when he took me to the position and said, "This is what I want you to do," he explained to me the mannerisms of this, because I was meeting a senior vice president of the bank, and this is the multi-million-dollar banking division, and he will explain to you what they do. I said, "Okay." So he did. He explained, he said, "So you want to be in banking?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." And he explained to me what they did and the clientele that they worked with. They only work with the captains of industry. They only work with heads of governments. They only work with Fortune 500 companies and up. Those were our clientele. So
Your starting
basically,
job.
that's where I started. So that's where I
Wow.
started. But knowing who you are, I knew who the bank was just simply from reading what they had in the advertisement. I read some other things, you know, about them, what have you. And so I understood the bank and I understood banking. And so therefore, and I understood finance because I grew up on a farm. So I understood invoices, invoice. I understood getting loans, that sort of thing. And those were the questions that he asked. And when I told him where I had come from, and it was like, "Oh, I grew up on a 20-acre blueberry farm." He said, "Oh, okay." So he knew that I had been around and I understood what it meant and how to handle clientele, how to handle the people that work for a company and that worked for you, what you needed to do to keep your workers happy, what you need to do to keep the association happy with your products that you have to make certain that you had a quality product and it was on time, all these types of things. So basically, I came with experience.
He recognized it. He asked the right questions as well, and you were prepared with those answers in a way that served them.
There you go. That I love what you just said, in a way that served them. I was not there to serve myself. What I knew was this. Once I had the okay to come down to talk to the human resources director, no longer was any of the conversations or anything that I would do about me. It was all about the bank, and it was about what they needed and what they needed me to do.
How long? Obviously, you start off with a bang. You start off on the right road. It's going well. How long did you stay in that position?
I stayed actually in that particular position for 2 years, and then I became a land trust officer. And up for the bank, not for Central National Bank. I actually left American National. I got married, referred my husband to the bank, and he became the department head, a supervisor for the data department. And so they, because of you can't have the two of you working there together at a bank of that size, which was fine, but I already had secured a position as a land trust officer at American, I'm sorry, at Central National Bank right down the street.
Once again, what a nice transition step that you
Right.
made.
So
I
that's
love
where,
that.
yeah. So, and again, that was in my backyard. That was in my forte. It was land. It was land trust. I had worked with trust. We had trust. There really wasn't, it was not a stretch. I can tell you this. It was definitely not a stretch. I learned a lot, but probably the only thing I had not done when I had come to the bank is I had never really gone and sat in court. When there are different large cases that someone brings against the trust, what have you, and we have to represent the trust as the bank that holds the trust for the person. That was the only thing I hadn't done, but just had the experience in court. After a couple of times of doing that, it became very familiar.
That time for the next thing. So, what's the biggest pivot then that changes the trajectory of what you're working on that puts you towards what you do now?
The biggest pivot, I would say this, is the change in what's going on in the world and how we do things. I decided I wanted to go. Central National Bank was being sold, and they Citibank came in, and Citigroup actually will come in and they hold the bank until they can find a suitor for the bank. And one of the things I talked about with one of the senior vice presidents, we just had a candid conversation, Tom and myself, and we talked about where would you want to land? What do you want to do? How do you want to do it? He talked to each of us individually and what have you. And I said, I wanted to get into computers. And he's, oh, okay. And what was interesting was we have, since you're the bank, you basically, you know everybody. You know everybody who is anybody. So he said, Mather Wannabarup, which is the largest advertising agencies. I know the gentleman over there who's the head of the print production. And he actually had did a speech and said that they were going to be bringing in the computer-aided design, and they were going to be bringing that into the agency. And he said that would be an excellent place for you to land and to learn about computers because they'll send you to school and you can learn about computers and what have you. And I did. And to this day, I still have all the relationships that I'm speaking to you about. I still have connections with those people who are still with us. But yes, I went to Ogilvy & Mather, the third largest advertising agency in the country. And I've studied computers and then learned about advertising, marketing, public relations, and journalism. I went to Columbia College there on Michigan Avenue in Chicago and got my education, got my degree in computer science. And there I pivoted into because I wanted to really understand computer science. And I went to a company that was actually an upstart, an emerging technology company, X-Scribe. And X-Scribe Communications, X-Scribe Corporation, rather, what they did was they computerized the court reporting industry, put a RAM memory access board on the bottom of a Steno machine. And that's why when you see, we also designed that, you see that closed caption for the hearing impaired that goes by the translating. We designed that as well. That was one of the services that we had, one of our extended services. And so therefore, when I got into that, I became the district service manager for the central US and the eastern half of Canada. So I went all the way up to Nova Scotia and all the way out to Quebec, to Montreal, and then from north to south in the United States. I had 11 service centers that I was in charge of, and the company had a total of 22 service centers, and I was over half of them.
And
Relationship
you, when you land on that last one, how old are you after you've touched this many industries?
How old am I? I'm glad you asked, because my birthday, and maybe they can sing happy birthday, my
Who's your
birthday
birthday?
actually May 7th,
Right around the corner.
and I will be turning 67.
My gosh. So by the time you've done all this, we'll give you a pre-birthday celebration here.
Well, thank you.
I love it. I love it. But tell me, by the time you've hit all these major industries that, as you can see, really serve where you end up, how old are you at this point in your career? At that point?
At that point in my career, that was not the last pivot. That
Okay,
was
tell me one more.
that was not the last pivot. With advertising with X-Scribe, we actually sold X-Scribe. I came to them in 82, and in 1989, we sold the company, went IPO, and we sold off the company to NCR, National Cash Register. And so at that point, I got remarried. Okay. I got remarried. And at that time, my husband, he worked for the attorney who I'm still married to now. So he worked for the attorney general's office. And then he decided one day he wanted to go into telecommunications. Now, I had gone back to the bank. So I had went back into banking, and we went to doing my usual thing in banking. But he did go, and he went to TCI, which would later become Comcast, and then it would later then it would, then Comcast was sell, no it would later the Comcast I think MCI not Comcast but MCI they would later become MCI, and how the bells just keep rolling. And so we ended up, they wanted to have a company, one of Cox Communications, which is actually in Atlanta and has a footprint out on the West Coast because of
Oh,
us.
yes, here too, Cox is big.
Exactly. In Arizona, we're very big. And we had something to do with that, because then I began starting Cottage Industries in about 82, not Cottage Industries, but really my own businesses, still working for major corporations, but also at the same time, I began with my own businesses. And so one of the businesses that I had was a computer regulatory company. So we would do computer design work and regulatory work for companies. And so Cox Communications hired us because they wanted to have a footprint on the West Coast. They only had a footprint in the Southwest at that time. So that's how we helped them to get out to where you see them now, very deep and very entrenched on the West Coast. And that was through, we handled the regulatory and the operational systems and support to help them. That's how you can see how regulatory has to go hand in hand, obviously, with technology. So basically, if people are really paying attention, Kelly, they will see that all of the things that I've done and the way that I did them in such a way that made sense. Certain businesses, certain things have to go together. You need those as we begin to change. We basically, what I'm saying is, I came into the era where we still had the mimeograph machines, okay? Where the data centers were literally a whole building was the data center, and you didn't have this one office, and you didn't even have the personal desk computer that you have today. And so I got into the design. When I went into computers, I went into the design of hardware, of software. Basically, we had to program everything. Now you basically everything is a point and click, and it's going to know they if they only knew just how much lines of code it takes to point that pointer, and how many lines of code it takes to have us look like we look. This GUI interface that we have, this picture here, these graphics, just to build these systems. We were a part of building those systems, but knowing that's your future, that's the future, then what you do is you set yourself up to be that one that jump gates you into that future. And it's basically, you know what the future is, you know what you want it to do, and you're standing at the precipice. You're standing here, like you said, at that pivot time where the world is pivoting. It's not just simply me pivoting. And again, as you can see, once I walked through that door back in 1976 in July, no longer was whatever I was going to do and whoever I was going to do it for, it was no longer about me. It's always from that point forward about who I would serve and what they needed to have done.
It's just honestly, and we haven't even gotten to everything yet, but you've been on a stunning trajectory, really so well laid out, so logical. The next logical step in what you do. I love for the audience to get to hear how you get there from one point A to point B. You've got a killer pedigree, obviously. And honestly, audience, we're not even there yet. It's just the beginning. All the preparatory work that she has done to get where she is today to be able to help so many people. So that's really my next question, is that you're really known as being a disruptor to traditional thinking. You challenge the status quo. That mindset obviously got developed from an incredible amount of knowledge that you had acquired over time. A lot of people chase success, but few people align with their purpose. You seem to have aligned with your purpose like immediately. It doesn't seem like it took you a lifetime to get there. You really created a personal mission. And how did that actually come together? Was it always with you, or did
It
it
was
actually develop?
always with me. And what happens is this: you said it right there in a sentence. I created a personal mission. So basically, what happens is I'm a futurist, and I've always been that my entire life. I'm always looking to the future. What happens? How do we do it? You can go back to anyone in my little small town from my little high school graduating class, and they'll tell you, Yvonne has always been that person who made us think about the future and not just today. When the class wanted to, I was president for 2 years and V vice president for the fourth year, because I really didn't feel like being that. I really what it was, I wanted to be president of the Senate, is what I wanted to do. And I couldn't be president of the class and president of the Senate. So let me be honest, okay? Because somebody will come and say, no, that's not why she did that. She did that because she wanted to be president over the Senate. And she knew she couldn't be president over the class and president over the Senate at the same time. So it's out there. I said it. So basically, but what I did with the senior class, we were building, the school had built a new school, and all of us in the senior class had, for our whole entire life, they were always trying to build a new school in the town of Covert, Michigan. And so therefore we finally got it. It finally got passed. It was kept getting voted down in the 60s. And finally at the late 60s or early 70s, it got voted in. And then so in 76, the building was finished, the auditorium was ready, and so we would be the first class graduating out. Now, of course, the old building hadn't been torn down, the old gymnasium rather hadn't been torn down. And that's where everybody had graduated. So most people knew their families, their friends had graduated out of there. Some of them, even their parents, had graduated. So they were feeling the nostalgia of, let's be the last class that graduates out. And so here in walks Yvonne with this goodness. Here she comes. Oh, no, what we need to be is, we don't be known to be the last. You want to be known to be the first. Because what will happen is when they tear down this old gymnasium, which it was going to be torn down as a part of the buildup, once that's torn down, then nobody will remember that. Even when you bring your children back here years from now, you come back for alumni dinners, for celebrations, or what have you, what you're going to see, where you're going to be in this new school. And so you want to be able to have your picture up there as the very first class that graduated. And I got the school board on my side by saying, see, some of these people here, they could see their parents or their ancestors who were there, who had graduated, out of old school, what have you. And then the ones they were pushed to the side, the ones that had graduated before they had the first school. And so it's like, I said, yeah, don't we want to be like you? Yeah, so they voted it down. So of course we went to graduation, everybody had rocks in their jaws. But 10 years later, when we came back, oh my goodness, they gave us this whole big spiel, this whole big thing about how we were the first class that had graduated, and they felt good. And so they're my
So
friend.
you are a futurist. That's
Yeah,
it. Like
that's
it
it.
from the get-go, that's just who you are, and you're patient to allow for it to be delivered, but it will be delivered, clearly. I love that. That's certainly a sign. Now I look at you. You are helping businesses secure funding in an incredible range, 50 million to 120 billion. These are serious numbers. I really want to get some questions answered here on what you think are the common mistakes that you see entrepreneurs and businesses making when they approach capital raising, and how your company, Sanpete Financial Group, how do you flip that narrative?
One of the three of the biggest mistakes that they make, Kelly, and that is, number one, they do not know their investor. They have no idea what that investor does and what the investor wants to do, how that investor, where they garner their monies from to actually be able to make those types of loans, or where they're actually going. What types of things does that investor want to do? Who do they want to invest with, and how and what they want to do? That's the first mistake. They don't know the investor. The second mistake is, and generally you'll have a novice who doesn't really understand, and they don't understand that a venture capitalist or venture capital is not bank monies. So it's not you going to your local bank and trying and applying for a loan. And so they really have to understand the world, whether that's they're getting it from seed capital from an angel investor. They have to understand the world of investment and what it really means to have an investment. Years ago, we just now, probably within the last 30 years, have gotten to the point where we've opened the doors, and we're open. Then we just opened it a little teeny bit, and now it's getting open more and more. It's not completely wide open, believe it or not, to no stretch of the imagination, but the door is open to bring in these innovators. Innovators, someone who does not have, say, 7+ years of business and of working in industry under their belt, were never invited into the VC community. There was no such thing as angel investors. That whole level of angel investors, they had to fight very hard to be able to get that level put in. You started at the VC level, which meant you had to be in business 10, maybe 15 or 20 years before you even came. Because what you had to understand, just the gravitas of actually having that much money invested in your company, and then having an investor that you owe 3 to maybe 10x times what you had borrowed. That's a lot of money. That's not when you go to get a loan and that loan is even 10 or 12% or 3% or what have you. That's nowhere near. Those dollars are much, much higher. And then that person has ownership in your company, and then therefore that means they can take ownership if you don't pay that debt. And it's only been in the last 20 years that it has even been allowed to say that that the investor has to have a caveat in the loan, in the documentation that says they will offer a convertible note. That when it first started 30 years ago, that was like, if they have to take a convertible note, I'll just take the business. I'm not going to deal with an installment debt. Simply because venture capitalists felt that if that were the case, then they should really be over at their bank getting a loan. and should not be dealing with the investment community. And so therefore, this community is very, when you think about it, in the just the simple funding of a business who may be coming out brand new, what have you, this is all totally new, even to the investors. You have a lot of investors coming into the business, but you have a lot of old world, like the BlackRock, Sequoia, the usual suspects, the older companies in business, the Berkshire Hathaways, what have you, where they won't even take, they still don't take on. They may, some of them have created smaller offshoot companies from theirs to do this type of work at this level, at the innovation level, but you can still, you cannot walk into a BlackRock and just simply be an upstart company and want to get funding. They won't, you won't be getting it from them, and you definitely won't be getting it from Berkshire Hathaway. You may be getting it from one of their offshoot, but then you would still have to have proven yourself, have a proven record. So you can't just come in with, I have an idea, or I want a challenge. When NASA or DOD or someone said that my project was good and they would buy something from me, they'd be like, oh, that's nice. I can refer you to someone.
This is why then you're such a champion of non-dilutive financing, right? Where you don't, the business owner doesn't have to give up a percentage of their company. Why do you think, or why do you believe that more entrepreneurs need to rethink how they fund their growth? And what's the danger of following traditional VC route without understanding the trade-offs? Why are you
Danger.
going to give up your IP? Why are you going to give this up?
The danger is the loss of your IP. The danger is because, see, what happens is this. When they come and they want to, right, they'll do a pro forma, 5 year, 3 year, 5 year performance. And that is a projection. And many times, and that projection is based on what we think the market is going to do. Obviously, the founder can do as best they can to predict what the future is going to look like and to predict what the clients are going to look like and the market is going to actually look like. When you actually get into it, that 9 times out of 10, that doesn't happen. The market changes, the market, it may be soft, it may look, or it may be buying those types of items, but not necessarily from you. So if that happens, now you've just put yourself on the risk. And because many of these companies are taking the bulk of their money from single source, we do everything we can to try to educate them about the capitalization table. It needs to be diverse. You do not need your money coming from one source, and you don't need it all at one time. And so they have to understand how to bring that money in, go out, make money. The what's most important in a business is that you have customers. That's the most important thing to a business. You have to have, yes, good leadership. You can go out and you can continue to hire good leadership. You can't hire clients. You can't hire customers. And you cannot make it just simply on subscription rates. If you look at the subscription models, the reason why you see the subscription models going to the annualized and many of them are not taken on the monthly is because people would drop off or they wouldn't pay
Sure.
the. They wouldn't pay their month. So if you've got 100,000 subscribers and 50,000 people didn't pay their monthly subscription, what happens to your bottom line? What happens to your operation during that month that you're trying to collect that monies from them? And so this is why the subscription models have now gone, they got smart about it and they said, no, you're going to pay the subscription annually or you're not going to be our business, our client, because why? We can't, there's nowhere else for us to go to get recoup these funds or get this money during the year or during that time. So this is why they do it that way. They say at least we know for one solid year we do everything, our operational expenses are covered. So they really have to understand a lot about how to do business. And we have too many times, we have too many people thinking that I can do this all by myself. You can't. You cannot. You've got to have a team behind. You have to have something more than, say, a person to do your taxes at the end of the year. You need an accountant. You need somebody who is going to, you need someone who is going to actually be there at all times. So you can't have just, you need to have financial advisors. You need a team of attorneys. You need, and if you don't have that, you need access to that. You need some CFOs. That's why they have fractional CFOs now. They've got attorneys who will work with you on a, they've always worked on retainer basis, so as needed. But you need to have these things in place for you to even look like you are a legitimate business. Other than that, you don't look legitimate, because if something happens, you have to think about it like this. If I have invested in your business $3 million, $10 million, and now because you did not have any attorney, or you didn't have a financial advisor or CPA that you worked directly with, and someone came in and sued your business, guess what's going to happen? What's going to happen to my money? That's the deep pocket. I am the deep pocket. And it's out of your control. And I'm sorry, you telling me out of my control, that's not good enough for me. So now what am I coming after? And a lot of people, I tell them they want to do everything with an LLC. And I said, no, you get a corporation. You get an LLC. That's a limited liability corporation. And guess what? That means that you, as a managing member, you are the one who is responsible for everything. And if you have several other people, the three or four of you are still the personally responsible for this, not the business. But it's the business that's in business, not you personally. So therefore, the
So important. This information is so important for our people to see because entrepreneurs often feel they're overwhelmed. Yes, they're stressed out, but they feel like they can do it themselves. But the truth is, if you need capital, you got to be able to show that you're more than one person because everything would be dependent on you. Regardless, legally, absolutely everything you said is so true. But also from the investors' point of view, they don't want to be reliant on one person who's dancing on all sides trying to do everything. You need to have a reputable team. And really, it's so much work to do things on your own, so much more enjoyable to have a team of people that are pulling together your vision and operating together. That's in addition to. Now, I got to ask you, there's also a falsehood out there. AI has just gone crazy and it's just jumping to the next level with AGI. Once again, giving people this idea that oh, this can do everything for me. I don't need to have anybody else on board. I'm now a wizard. I can do everything. Yes, AI is powerful. It's getting more powerful. But still, if you're looking for an investor, they're going to want more than you and all your AI experience, your all the bells and whistles that you can do. They're going to want to speak to that. How do you see integration of AI into businesses right now? How do you see that as helping founders that actually need to be thinking about this not as just a tool, but a growth driver?
And yes, and it will be. Think about AI. Then many founders, those who are a little bit older, they will remember when they put computers on everybody's desk from typewriters.
I was there. I got you.
And then they will remember when they went from just the computer that was connected to the company's network to giving people laptops. And then giving people phones that literally are computers or tablets or what have you. We make progressions, and our devices do a lot for us. Yes, we have to have an AI plan and an AI strategy. And you really have to look to that future, because that's going on in everybody's industry. You don't look to AI to say, I want it to do it for me. You look, how can we utilize AI in our company side by side to make us better at what we do? What you don't want to do is with AI, one of the things, yes, they went from AI, now we're talking about AGI, but there's the next level up that you have to almost at the same time be looking for, and that's cognitive AI. And so
Yes.
therefore, yes, and that's where you train the AI to have what you literally will be like a digital twin. And so it speaks the way you actually speak, other than it's the AI. If you look at just AI, and you wrote a letter, when you see like Gemini come up, when you're trying to write your letter, and then all of a sudden, if you use Google, it wants to jump in and make the letter or what have you. you and I, we're jumping in and we're writing a letter to someone, it's literally going to be the same letter.
Yes.
I see them come all day long. And I'm like, I just read this. I'm thinking, there's something wrong with me. I just read this. And I did that a couple of times. And I said, oh, okay, they're using AI and they're getting the same canned type stuff. And then I
What?
begin.
Yvonne, I agree with you so much. You end up getting all this information. It all looks exactly the same, and it's having the opposite effect. Initially, it was like, wow, this is really well written. This is that you really communicated that well. And now you look at it and you think, you're lazy. You completely used AI. You didn't even take the time to add your voice, your nuance,
Boys
and what
do,
made you
right.
unique. It's crazy.
So therefore, what you're going to get is, so when you go to cognitive, here's the key though. When you go to cognitive, you still have to be very careful because now you got a digital twin. So you want to make certain that you're in there writing these things and AI is not taking over and writing everything or putting everything out there, acting as you. That's how you get to the next level. Well, which is, it's already here. These levels are already here, and that's the deep fakes. That's the deep fakes. Because then that way, what happens is the question then becomes, Kelly, did you send me that email? Or you say, no, I never sent you an email. I never said anything. I didn't send you that contract. I didn't sign that contract.
I think those are some real considerations
Those are some
moving
very,
forward, don't you?
oh, those, especially in my industry. Because what we do is we send out things on the different programs like DocuSign and all the different signing type programs and what have you. So what happens when now DocuSign is like at your desktop where you can just simply sign it very easily. So I've got 100 documents on my desktop and I say, AI, sign these documents for me. And what then 100 more come to that? Oh, she's busy. She's overwhelmed. She's flying to Istanbul. I'll sign them for her. I haven't even had a chance to review them.
These are the challenges we have coming up. As
I
exciting as
know.
AI is, and I'm loving it, I'm enjoying it. We're moving into that cognitive AI. There's still something to, as exciting as the adventure is, you still got to look at what are the implications here? How is this going to change how we do business and still be able to do business with integrity, intention, and accountability? These are
Right.
still very important issues.
Very important. And I'm not saying to not have AI. What I am saying is put together an AI team the same way that your predecessors put together a computer integration team. They put together a network integration team. How will we integrate the network? How do we make it so that when we're working on the network, there are always different ways that you could hack into the network and looks like you did the work and know somebody else did it or what have you. So you want to put together those same types of groups, those same types of teams is going to look at this very carefully and going to integrate this into your organization.
Yeah, this all leads to wonderful developments, but it just leads to more interesting questions. And I can't wait. I'm so glad to have you in my life because you are so far ahead of the curve on so much of this. I've got to ask you a question. I cannot let you escape without talking about space. How you have ended up so integrated into space and the Department of Defense accelerators. I want to know how that happened and how you feel about what's going on in that arena.
Okay, that, see, everything goes back to the beginning. I guess Freud was right. Everything goes back to the beginning. My nickname is Sputnik, and that is, I was born in 58, and that is after the first Russian satellite that went up, Sputnik. In 57. And I've been a space baby ever since. And I guess you could say I finally got to NASA by stalking, literally by stalking. I went to every one of their, they finally, I guess it started about in 95. Where I'm reading an article and they had put out and said that they would have no in that November where they would introduce their different technologies that they had. So I went to every one of those technology introductions and they were showing this is what they had and they were asking companies to actually take and commercialize this. And that's how like Nortel the telecommunications, they took some of it, and they know some of the different tele the Wi-Fi is began that technology to build that technology. And then with the actual telephones, and when I was in the communication, that's what got me deep into the operation side of the telecommunications because of that, and tried to get on the forefront. So yeah, I became a stalker of any type of technology that they did, and just happened to in 22, it was they were having a at Galveston, they were having where the scientists were coming out and speaking with the innovators. And they were so basically, if you had an innovation, come to this event, what have you. And then they didn't say right straight out, but they basically said they would have investors there. Of course, who's in Galveston? Who's there? Okay. So I went to Galveston. This is January 22. And when I got there, you had, of course, the Lockheed Martins, the Boeing, all there. They had the big exhibits, and then the NASA scientists were there, and companies who were looking for funding or what have you. So I'm sitting at the front of the room, myself, my team, and they asked for all the VCs and investors to stand up. So we stood up, and we're facing the front of the room, and we're making the assumption we're figuring, okay, everybody, there's several VCs throughout because the place was huge. And we're then Dr. Carol, she said, "Oh, would you come up?" And I'm thinking she's talking to somebody behind me. She don't know me. So I'm like, "Sure." She said, "No, you." So I came on up and everything. And so she said, "Well, thank you so much for being here. And what is your name?" And so I told her what my name was, what my company was, and what have you. She said, "Guess what?" She said, "We're going to have to hear from you. And we're going to have to hear all about San Pete Financial Group because you are the only VC in the room. You are the only investor here." I looked around. What? At that point, why did I get nervous? I swear I got them first time speaking nervousness. I'm like, oh, okay. I expected we were one of the lesser. I just knew I expected to see the parade of stars of VCs companies and investor companies to be there. This is NASA for crying out loud. Okay, so I did my speaking, and afterwards that whole it was a 3-day conference, and that was the first day. And it was every moment of every day. I even had
Yvonne, that's always my question for people is when did you realize that public speaking was going to be such an important skill set for you and was going to change the trajectory of your business? This is the best story I've ever heard so far of someone who wasn't planning on speaking that day and it changed the game for you. And you've become such an avid speaker now. You are everywhere. But it really influenced your business. It was so many people need to realize this can be essential to scaling your influence.
That
And,
is,
right?
yeah, that is all of you even listen beyond what Kelly is telling you. She said, this could be, no, you have to. It is not a choice. If you want to be taken serious in your industry, you have to be speaking into your industry. That's your value. That's who you are. It's not just simply your backstory or what you've done, but you have to speak on the topics, on the issues, what's happening today. You have to be at these forums and be seen as a present, as an impactful person who is making the changes in the industry, who is creating the industry. You become a thought leader in your, there's, my goodness, I'm pretty sure Kelly and myself could probably just go on and on for hours on end about all the things that you do. What happens is it also makes you a better leader. Because why? What you have, every time you speak, all eyes are on you. When I was in that room that I just told you about, here, I've got people there from with way more experience than I do. I got companies with deeper, with pockets so deep, you feel like you're jumping into the Grand Canyon. And here they are. I'm looking out into the audience, and they're looking at me and hanging on my every word, hanging on what I had to say about what we do and how we do it. And then speaking to me afterwards, coming, can we having coffee and donuts and cake and meet you at this time, talk to you at that time. And then on after that, it just opens up so many doors and avenues. You now become the person that is being spoken about in rooms that you don't even know, places that you've never gone, and you're getting invited to sit, next to or be a part of. They're asking you to come to the NASDAQ and ring the bell, and you're like, okay, that wasn't even on my bucket list or things to do list, but you know what? I'll be on the plane coming to New York and I'll be ringing the bell right along with you. But these are the types of things. But if you don't avail yourself, then you don't need to be out there asking for a dime, because what's going to happen is this. Where are you? What are you doing to actually make this world truly a better place with your innovation, with your company, with what you have to offer? And everybody has something to offer. Everyone has something to offer. And whether or not you speak in front of a large audience, a small audience, you get on a podcast, talk to somebody somewhere.
Yvonne Campbell, this is the perfect place to end this interview, though I don't want to. So I'm going to call this part one because you have to come back. That is the absolute culmination, the perfect place to stop with this interview because you've given the best advice anyone could give on this topic. I'm amazed at what you've accomplished, but I appreciate what you bring to the table and how you're changing the world. You are stunning in the trajectory of your business. You're in your lane. If there's anybody I've ever met that so beautifully describes someone who is prepared for the opportunities and is living their purpose, you fit the bill. I love this. Thank you so much for being here today.
You're quite welcome. And I appreciate so much, Kelly, Miss O'Hara, being on your show. And I look forward to coming back because we're just getting started.
That's my next line. We're just getting started. There are so many things for us to cover that unfortunately we had a time constraint this time, But please know I cannot wait to have you back again. You are in a world of not just making a difference, but also helping people, helping companies raise millions of dollars, literally, no exaggeration. And we've just barely scratched the surface. But for those entrepreneurs, there are so many avenues out there. And you have to get prepared and be ready for the opportunity that you're asking for. I am so confident that our listeners that are leaving this conversation, they're going to get it. There's just no clearer vision. There's zero room for excuses. This information is out there, and Yvonne Gamble is out there to give it to us. I want to share with you her book that we didn't even get a chance to cover. We will cover it the next time, but she has a book called Financing Your Next Billion Dollars. Know your impact, stand out from the crowd, and get funded. This is available on Amazon. If you're serious about raising capital without losing control of your company, this is your playbook. And if you want more of Yvonne's brilliance, and let's be honest, who doesn't? Head over to sandpeakfinancialgroup.com and see how she's helping entrepreneurs secure the kind of funding that turns big ideas into billion-dollar realities. Yvonne, you just don't talk about impact, you amplify it. And you gave absolutely the best dissertation on how to bring value with public speaking. You just couldn't have said it better. I'm thrilled to have had you on the show. And to everyone out there, listen, if this lit a fire under you, go ahead and share and subscribe it. It helps us. We love hearing how these conversations really spark new ideas for your business. So don't be shy. Drop us a message, drop us a comment. Every bit of engagement, it helps us bring insights from the best in the game, like Yvonne Gamble. So here on the Speaker Spotlight, we're all about showing you how stepping up to the mic can transform not just your business, but the way the world hears your message. It's not just about speaking, it's about amplifying your influence. Once again, great to have you with us, Yvonne. And to
Great
all
to
of you out there, I look forward to our next conversation. Come back again, Yvonne. I'll be booking you immediately.
Okay, thank you.
See you later, everybody. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.